States of America and to the Republic for which it stands.
Please call the roll.
Mr. Dudley?
Yes.
Ms. Anthony?
Here.
Ms. Hoppy? Mr. McDavid?
Here.
Mr. Schmidt?
Here.
Mr. Thornhill?
Here.
Mr. Kessel?
Here.
We have minutes for the regular council meeting, July 18, 2011. If there are no corrections, may I have a motion second for approval?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. If there are no extractions to the or additions to the agenda, may I have a motion and a second for approval?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. Welcome to the meeting. We have several opportunities for public comment, public hearings, old business, new business, and there is an open comment section at the end of the meeting. You're entitled to 3 minutes. If you represent an organization or a group, you are entitled to 5 minutes. The first item on the agenda is appointments to the Citizens Police Review Board. We had 11 applicants for one vacancy. So I'll have the clerk call the roll. Let me say, going into this, that one of the great things about Columbia is the qualifications, experience, intelligence of the people we see on these boards and commission. We're really, really blessed. I think I want to vote for about 5 people, but I think we only get to vote for one. So let's start by with the roll call.
Mr. Dudley?
Roger Dallas.
Ms. Anthony?
Mitchell Richards.
Mr. McDavid?
Roger Dallas.
Mr. Schmidt?
Mitch Richards.
Mr. Thornhill?
Dallas.
Mr. Kessel?
Roger Dallas.
Dallas has 4.
We'll move to public hearings. B-194-11.
Council Bill 194-11 is an ordinance determining it is in the public interest to construct improvements at the Thomas E. Country Atkins Jr. Memorial Park Baseball Complex, approving and adopting plans and specifications, determining that a portion of the work shall be done by contract, calling for bids through the purchasing division, determining that a portion of the project shall be done by city employees, providing for payment for the improvement, authorizing the city manager to obtain, execute, and record all documents necessary for the improvement, providing for compliance with the prevailing wage law and state-mandated construction safety training, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff report, please.
This project does 2 really important things, bathrooms and a concession stand. So we're excited about it. I know the public is. I've already had comments myself. Mike is here for any more detailed questions, but excited to ask you for approval to do that.
Questions from council?
Will this enable you to host any larger tournament events because of the improvements?
Yes, I believe it will, particularly adding the third field, which is under construction right now, and this project includes the lighting for that field. The 3 fields will allow us to host larger events. Having the concession and restroom facilities will make it much more attractive. That, quite honestly, we hear lots and lots of positive comments about the quality of the baseball fields there, and then they go, but you got to do something about the porta potties. And so I do think building the concession restroom next is a high priority. Ultimately, we'd like to build out the additional 2 fields, and once we have the 5 fields built, then we really will be in good position to at least bid on some really nice tournaments.
4th and 5th fields are in the parks tax?
No, not at this time. This $850,000 for this project was in the parks tax to finish the 3rd field and the restroom concession facility.
So we don't have funding for the 4th and 5th.
No, we're going to continue to look for possible grants like the one we just picked up on the 3rd field. And if things would go really well on the costs on this, we might be able to start on the 4th field as well. But we're not going to say that till we know, what the cost can.
Field cost.
It varies because it depends on whether we build it with our own crews or whether we construct it on a contract basis. But I would say, well, the lighting itself will run between $125,000 and $150,000. The fencing, the remainder of the improvements, probably close to another $100,000.
Any other questions? I'm going to open the public hearing. Would anyone like to speak? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing. Council discussion?
Well, we always need more ball fields. I'm hearing about the shortage of ball fields, and so any way that we can help is good. So we're pleased to do what we can.
Two comments. Number one, I called Tom Atkins today to once again thank him publicly or privately for this contribution. You know, we've talked about sports tourism, and you know, there's a big difference between having three fields and five fields in the scope of what we can bring into the community, and the number of people eating in restaurants and a number of hotel rooms staying in. So I don't know if we're going to get the money. It seems to be a problem for a lot of people these days, but I think that will really enhance our sports mission once we get that done. Any other comments? The clerk call the roll, please.
Council Bill 19411, Mr. Dudley?
Yes.
Ms. Anthony?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Schmidt?
Yes.
Mr. Thornhill?
Yes.
Mr. Kespel?
Yes.
Consent agenda. Will the clerk read the bills, please?
Items on the consent agenda include Bills 18911, 19011, 19111, 19211, 19311, 19511, 19611, 19711, 19811, and resolutions 12011, 12111, 12211, 12311, 12411, 12511, 12611, 12711, 12811, 12911, 12911, 12911, 12311, and 13111.
Please call the roll.
Bills 18911, 19011, 19111, 19211, 19311, 19511, 19611, 19711, 19811, and resolutions 12011, 12111, 12211, 12311, 12411, 12511, 12611, 12711, 12811, 12811, 12911, 12911, 13111, and 13111. Mr. Dudley?
Yes.
Ms. Anthony?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Schmidt?
Yes.
Mr. Thornhill?
Yes.
Mr. Kespel?
Yes.
New business, R-132-11.
Council Bill 13211 is a resolution authorizing an agreement for engineering services with Trek Design Group, LLC, for completion of the FY 2011 inflow and infiltration study of the sewer collection system.
Staff, please.
This is really important work. We have worked with Trek before with good result, and for those watching who aren't up on it, this is basically to find water that we don't want to get into the sewer system that's getting in, and then that helps us end that that issue. So, for example, we've hired Trek before. They identified 146 private and 34 public inflow and infiltration sources, and so now we can begin the work to get those to stop. We're recommending hiring them again for a phase two of that project to take on more of the area of the city and continue to do that work for us. This would be a not to exceed amount of $684,000, $684,377, and funded from the sewer utility. Any more details, and I would have to defer to John. Who's here?
Council questions.
I have a comment. I may be the sitting member who is in Basin D, and I, my neighborhood participated in that survey, and I personally met with the people who came into my house. I was very impressed with the service and the education, and so I'm very I'm actually can speak favorably for Trek and the work that they did in the Basin D area.
Any other questions by council? Would anyone from the public like to speak? Seeing none, council discussion?
I'm sorry, I got the order wrong there.
Please call the roll.
Council Council Bill 13211, Mr. Dudley?
Yes.
Ms. Anthony?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Schmidt?
Yes.
Mr. Thornhill?
Yes.
Mr. Kespel?
Yes.
R133-11.
Council Bill 13311 is a resolution authorizing the installation of solar electric photovoltaic systems on property under the control of the city's Public Works Department.
Staff, please.
One of those really neat projects that doesn't cost a lot and ends up exploring photovoltaics on land that's available from the Public Works Department. So Water and Light Public Works working together on a really kind of a neat project. I'll ask Ted and John to overview that a bit.
Well, as you know, I think the end of last year we had a solar lease project that we put together, and we are developing sites to put these solar photovoltaic generation facilities on. We gave a report to you showing some of the sites we're going to be developing that are Water and Light owned property, and what we're trying to do with this resolution is be able to develop some sites that are the water and the wastewater, or the, I think the solid waste and the wastewater utilities property. And I think there's three sites that we have that we've kind of detailed on here. I believe they are, we got 3.2 acres that we're looking at on Parkside Drive. That's over by the Cosmo Park area. We got 14.2 acres on, that is the landfill buffer property. That's over off of Waco Road. And then we got 142 acres that is the buffer property around the wastewater treatment facility. We've talked to Public Works, and we've basically using a agricultural lease rate to establish a lease payment for us to be able to lease this land from Public Works. And we are going to develop these sites going forward, and certainly we will be bringing our plans to you once we get to the point to where we start planning the ground out. It is priced at $50 a month with a 2% annual escalator that goes along with this, and our lease rate is going to be dependent upon the amount of ground that we actually end up using. So as we go by and the sites get bigger or the sites get developed more, then we will be paying more lease rate to the Public Works Department for these sites. The sites that we've currently brought to you in the past, just to make sure you know, is that we do have the materials on site to develop the sites that Water and Light owns, and it's currently in the design engineering phase for the connection portion of it. So those will be showing up soon. So we're needing some more ground to be able to expand our photovoltaic generation on.
When will the 6 megawatts be up and running?
Well, certainly the first phase that we have is going to be up and running in probably the next 3 months. Now, certainly the sites that we're talking about here with Public Works, I really don't know what the schedule on this. We're just going to have to wade through the development phase of this and find out how soon we can move those in there. Certainly, at this stage, we have a lot of the inventory that we need to put them up, but we need to do the design work and the site development work to be able to put them together. But we're still hoping to have a significant piece of it up by the end of this year.
Can you calculate this contribution to our renewable energy portfolio? Are you using a capacity number like 6 megawatts is your capacity, but are you going to use the number of megawatt hours over the total?
That's what our renewable energy ordinance is written around, is megawatt hours. It really doesn't, I guess, for lack of a better word, doesn't care how many megawatts we put in. The renewable energy ordinance is based upon the actual energy that's delivered to our system from these renewable energy sources. I think we've kind of calculated about a 20%, what they call a capacity factor. So if you take, you know, the number of hours a year times the capacity times 20%, that's the amount of energy that you're going to see delivered off these type of resources. But once again, we will certainly learn a lot as we get started with these systems in Missouri.
Are these systems going to help with peak load in the sense that it tends to be needed at hot times?
That's one of the reasons why we were very interested in developing solar or photovoltaic generation on our system, because it does match up better with the loads on our system. As you may know, the wind generators that we are involved with generally blow up more in the spring and the fall, which is when our loads aren't up as much. Days like this when the sun is out is when our loads are up, so they much better match our load profile as opposed to some other resources. So that's why we're really excited to be able to get some of these put up.
Yeah, well, what's particularly interesting about that is I guess we're still holding this to the same standard of only costing, what is it, 3% more than market or whatever. So this could, you know, maybe even be compared against a higher standard of what our peak load cost is.
Yeah, In our renewable energy portfolio that we put together, in evaluating the impact on rates, what you indicated, there's a 3% ceiling associated with that. How we evaluate some of these intermittent resources, and specifically in this case, is how much it compares with market rates. And certainly the market price of energy is significantly lower in the spring and the fall. So when you compare a wind resource with that type of market prices, it certainly stacks up different than if you compare these photovoltaic generators up against the market price in the heat of the summer, which is the time they're generating a lot. So it is going to have a different impact on the rate.
Okay. Any other questions? Would anyone from the public like to speak? Seeing none, council discussion. Please call the roll.
Councilbill 13311, Mr. Dudley?
Yes.
Ms. Anthony?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Schmidt?
Yes.
Mr. Thornhill?
Yes.
Mr. Kessel?
Yes.
Introduction and first reading. Will the clerk read the bills, please?
All bills are introduced by the mayor unless otherwise indicated. Bills 19911, 211, 201-11, 202-11, 203-11, 204-11, 205-11, 206-11, 207-11, 208-11, 209-11, 210-11, 211-11, 212-11, 213-11, 214-11, and 215-11, first reading.
Report 127-11.
This report is really reporting out on our experience with an experiment, with a pilot for taxi stands. I think we're 3 months in at this point, and the experience has been okay. And so what we're asking for is, you know, let's take another 3 months, 4 months, and see if that holds true during a semester, when college is in full swing. Any other details? I'd like to kick that over to the experts here.
If you guys have any questions, I'm free to take those from you.
I think I saw the numbers, and I don't remember where, to be honest, but that the number of citations for parking in the spaces illegally and cars being towed has decreased very dramatically, so I think folks understand now where the spaces are and that they can't park there.
Yes, we worked with Scott Betterman, the city traffic engineer, to better post those. And since that's happened, we're seeing less issues with people parking in those spaces that have been set aside.
And I'm not sure I understand, but one of the criticisms was the signs were too low so that people didn't see them. Is that what?
Correct. Yes, sir. There was criticism that they were too low on the meter. Public Works has now erected signs that are almost 6-7 foot tall that mm-hmm. exhibit where they can park and the restricted time parameters.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm going to move to direct staff to meet with taxi company owners and incorporate their suggestions and any tweaks that need to occur as we continue the pilot project through December.
Second.
Any discussion?
I was on record in this room a couple of meetings ago saying this was a solution looking for a problem. I did have the opportunity to spend about an hour around bar closing with several of your colleagues watching traffic come and go, and got a detailed explanation from the officers of how this works and what its purpose is. So I just wanted to say that I have listened to the facts and changed my mind. So,
what's your opinion of it? Do you think it's working?
My original concern was that we're an awfully small town to have something this complicated, and that I'm hearing issues on both sides, from business owners, from bar owners. I don't know, hopefully they'll be worked with as well, because there's this whole issue of what is their liability, how involved can they get, how involved can they not get in terms of getting people to a taxi. And I'm not sure that I understand their arguments pro and con, but I did have a good opportunity to discuss with the police officers, and you're the guys out there making the contact with the public at the scene, and a lot of what I hear as a councilman is anecdotal. So I was pleased to get the impromptu report at 2 in the morning that day.
Well, the motion is that this is a pilot study that will continue. Yeah. Through December, at which time we'll mm-hmm. evaluate it.
And if they can, I don't know if you're going to get a unified answer from the business community, but I hope that they'll include them in the discussion.
Any other discussion on the motion?
I just have one quick question that I should have asked originally. Are the taxi stands wheelchair accessible?
They're in close proximity. We could make it work for someone with ADA compliance. There are ramps in close proximity to all the corners there. Obviously, the spirit of the law, if we have a handicapped individual, the officers are going to use good judgment there and make sure that a cab can get to them, that sort of thing.
Motion and a second. All those in favor of the motion, second to continue the pilot study through December, say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. Report 128-11.
This is the fairly routine informational report about transfers inside departments, so really sort of a record of the funding path of funds. So but that as an informational piece.
I had one question just for some clarification on the very last item on the third page about the Transload Division's trucking business generating more income than expenses or revenue than expenses, but some sort of miscalculation on the expenses has created a need to transfer money. So what does that mean exactly?
I think that means they're doing better than we thought, but so we need to have a little more cash on hand. But I'll ask.
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
I'm just making sure I understand the need to transfer this money is because you underestimated how well the trucking would do. Is
yes,
that right?
That's exactly right.
But it has generated more revenue than expenses either way.
Yes, our ground transportation or the trucking contracts are certainly set up to generate more revenue than we expend on those, and it's really done better than we expected. So that's why we have to transfer the money to be able to pay to continue to pay the transportation bills for that service.
Thanks.
And it is from a contingency fund. I know you have it, but for those watching, it is from a contingency fund for that purpose. It's an allowable expense, I guess, is the way to say that.
That report is informational. We'll move on. 130-11.
129.
I'm sorry?
129-11.
Would you like variance? To skip to 130?
Okay, yeah, 129-11.
Again, this is informational only. There were two items on this report about stormwater variances. You can see the details on the report.
One questions? Report 130-11.
Well, remember a couple of small items, and that, maybe not small, big items from the past, route ideas about new electric lines. That work has proceeded, and this report is really informational get you up to where the process has come, and then it outlines the process that remains for those who can't quite make out the big screen. We are at the point where we're ready to go through a public process with these new ideas, gather that input, and then come back really for a final determination by council. But I know you may have had time to read those maps. They were big and lots of small different colored lines, so I'll Tad and Ryan, excuse me, are here to answer the details about that.
The 161 KV has been routed south and west. Does abut a couple of small subdivisions, it looks like. I don't know if Mrs. Anthony is.
I don't really have any questions on the line. I'd like to go through the 69 KV line. I'd like to hear a formal report and explain to us because that is troublesome.
Okay. Well, if it's okay, just real quick, I have some quickly, I want to review some of the information about this project. I want to make sure you guys know that, you know, there's still two primary goals of this project. And the first is we need to increase the transformer capacity to serve load in both the south and the southwestern parts of our system. We are certainly running out of space in our existing substations to serve these areas, both electrically and physically. So, second, we also need to add a transmission level connection to the west side of our system. Pershing Creek is the substation on our on the western side of our system where it makes a transmission level connection. But it only has one connection line to the Ameren system, and this is the redundant path that we need to get out there on our system. Right now, if we lost this transmission connection during peak loading situations, we would need to electrically reconfigure our system to avoid some line overloading. This reconfiguration will leave some of our substations on a radial or what is known as a single line feed, which will put customers on these substations at a higher risk of sustained outage on our system. So these are certainly the reason that we're needing these. In addition, if we had to do a reconfiguration of our system, we would risk the possibility of overloading some of the transmission elements on our neighboring systems, which is a compliance issue for us. On your screen here is the timeline that we have. Just want to make sure you guys know that at the November 22nd council work sessions, we were directed to evaluate an alternative transmission line routing to those presented in the original route alignment. These routes that were identified in the original route alignment are now referred to as the Option A alignments. The Option A is shown on the left side of the chart that you see on here. As shown, the current status of Option A is we have conducted the informational meetings, we have completed the evaluation study, and we have reported these results to council. The intent of really the Option A alignment study was to connect at 161 kV the new sub to Grindstone, the new sub to Pershing Creek, and the new sub to McMain. This configuration used three 161 kV lines. The intent of the alternatives in the new Option B alignment that we're here to discuss today is to connect the new substation at 69 kV using part of the existing 69 kV substations. This 69 kV route would be to go between the Grindstone and the new sub and the Hinkson Creek and the new sub. In addition to the new route on the Option B we have here is to connect the McBain substation to the Pershing Creek substation at 161 kV. This configuration uses solutions for both one 69 kV line and one 161 kV line. So as you said, you're interested in kind of going over some of the facts on what made us decide where we're going. I'll have Ryan real quick go over the presentation of the Route B route study that we have here at this time.
I'll start briefly with the 161 kV portion. Like Tad had mentioned, it was to add a second transmission level connection to the west side of town into our Pershing Creek substation. This eliminates the possibility of overloading, thus satisfying the NERC compliance issues that Tad had mentioned. There are two main route possibilities, as you can see on the drawing here. There's a red route and a green route, with two options: a blue route, which could go from the red route to the green route, or an orange route, which could be used to go from either the red route to the green route or the green route back to the red route. The red route heads west along Route K, then generally north along Scott Howard Orchard and South Bushwood Lake Roads, and continues north to the existing Pershing to Overton line right away, forming a double circuit with the existing line. And the green route heads west along Route K and then north along Scott Boulevard. The Mill Creek, or the Grindstone to Mill Creek section, this is the 69 kV portion, connects the new substation by inserting it into the existing 69 kV line from Hinkson Creek to Grindstone. This is an extremely short distance. As you can see on the map here, it's less than a mile, and so it's very challenging to come up with many alternatives in going such a short distance. Most of the routes overlap significantly, which is why you see so many dashed and dotted lines on this. The green route heads south from the existing 69 kV line to Nifong, and then follows west along Nifong, turning south along Southampton Drive, turning west towards Providence, then on to Mill Creek. The orange route heads north out of the substation to Nifong, then east along Nifong and Grindstone Expressway, turning north on East Green Meadows. The yellow route heads west along Grindstone Expressway from the existing 69 kV line, south along the Nifon Connector and South Hampton Drive, turning west towards Providence and then on to Mill Creek. And finally, the red route heads south along East Green Meadows from the existing 69 kV line, continuing on the Nifon Connector and South Hampton Drive, then turning west towards Providence and then on to Mill Creek. I'd like to point out that several of these lines, especially on the 69 kV portion here, have been suggested as double circuit lines. Those both have pros and cons associated with them. The pro is you get to have two lines on the same structure, but in the con of that is also you've got two lines on the same structure. So if you ever have a problem, such as a car accident or a lightning strike on that structure, especially since we're suggesting powering the substation just by these two lines, you would drop the entire substation if you ever had a problem using a double circuit line. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Tad to wrap up the summary.
Well, real quick before I end here, you can ask some questions from us here. So I know that you had some questions on this, and then I'll just kind of go over kind of the time frames that we see coming up next for us.
I have a couple of questions. If the purpose of what we're doing here is to make sure that we have redundancy, and now we have a report that the double circuiting takes that ability away, then these really aren't viable options, are they?
Well, there are several single circuit possibilities. You could come, for example, using the green route, and then the orange route would be two unique, different, separate single circuit possibilities. There would also be a yellow or an orange route, which would also present two single circuit possibilities on the 69 kV portion.
I mean, rather than make this more complicated than it needs to be, I don't know how everyone else feels, but if we can't have redundancy, I just don't think that they should be options. I just don't think it makes any sense. I would hate for us to go through this process and not accomplish one of our two goals.
Are we in the question phase or the comment phase?
Well, question. I have another question is, unless we can discuss this, I wouldn't mind discussing it if we're at this stage, because honestly, I don't think we're ready to go through to a public hearing.
Can I just follow up to make sure I'm tracking your question? Brian, can you point out with the mouse or something?
Sure.
So you're saying there are ways on this map, because quite honestly, I just see a lot of dots. There are ways to get two routes that aren't overlapping?
Correct. If you follow, this existing dark green line is our existing 69 kV line going in between Hinkson Creek and Grindstone Substation. If we were to intersect that line here, at this, where this light green line heads south, and bring that along this route here into the substation, that would form one line, and then head north out of substation on this orange route, back this way, and then up Green Meadows to intersect back with the dark green line. That would form two separate structures, or two separate lines that would not share any structures, and you would have no double circuit. You could also do similar routing with the yellow line or yellow route. You could follow the yellow route along Grindstone Expressway, down the Nifon Connector, down Southampton, and then west towards Providence, and then on to the Mill Creek substation site. And again, follow the orange section out around up to Nifon, east on the Nifon to Green Meadows, and then up Green Meadows back to the 69 kV existing line. That would form a separate or a different option, if you will. And then the rest of the, basically those two solutions would be non-double circuit lines, and then the other two solutions would be double circuit lines. So you have two single circuit lines options and two double circuit line options.
Thanks, sir.
It's my understanding that we asked for option B because of community resistance to the loops of 161 kV high voltage lines, the big metal structures, scaffolding with big lines in it, and that we asked for an alternative which took the 161 away from residences and replaced it with 69 kV lines, which don't look like that. Or do they?
No. And in fact, there's a misconception. The 161 that we're planning on using do not look like the big metal lattice towers that you're suggesting either. Both would follow along single poles that would overhang the street right-of-way. The only difference between the two would be the height of the poles. The 161 kV poles would be slightly higher than the 69 kV poles because of the phase-to-phase clearance issues because of the voltage differential.
My other question is, the reconstruction of the existing 69 kV line is necessary because larger conductors are required. Can you show us where on that map, and is that a significant expense?
Basically, we would have to reconductor all the way from the Grindstone substation through the new routes that we were going to the new substation, and then the remaining portion of the green line onto Hinkson Creek. That'll give us the amp carrying capability that would be required at the 69 kV voltage level, as opposed to doing it with the 161 kV voltage level. The higher the voltage, the less amps you need to have to support the same amount of load. So you get to carry a larger load on the same conductor at a higher voltage. So by requiring the new substation be powered at the 69 kV, we'll require the conductors in between that new substation and the other two substations to be larger conductors.
Which I think intuitively makes some sense because we have an existing 69 system there and we're adding load to the existing system. So we have to increase the amperage capacity on pieces of it.
Can I ask one more question? When would we be talking about possibly, both on both maps, I think we have the lines running near residential neighborhoods, and we have asked to have some discussion on putting, at least I did, putting some of those underground in those sensitive areas. When are we going to see that discussion?
Well, I believe our intention is once we have some routes that we feel like are routes that come out with a higher evaluation than others, we can certainly assign or give estimated cost to pieces that need to go underground. We've kind of given you some idea of the general concept of how the price differential between going overhead and underground and how much the cost is to make the transition of itself. But certainly when you get to the place where you say, I want it to go underground here and then come back above ground here, that's when we can start giving you a really good idea of what the cost differential is between the underground section and the overground section. But there is quite a bit of variance in there on what's it going through. To go underground, is there existing road and street infrastructure that we have to construct around, or is it just going through open ground? I mean, so these all have cost factors associated with them. Like I said, I think we've tried to do what we could to give you a kind of a ballpark idea of what it costs as far as a differential, but to get more defined on what it's actually going to cost for this section, we kind of need to know where the section is.
Vision that would be part of the process as we move forward, come back
yes.
with more defined.
Yes. And real quickly, I guess, in summary, this is a preview of the information that we're intending to present at our next interested party meetings for the transmission line routing. This interested party is going to have two focuses. As our last report indicated, we have the evaluation results from the option A that we're intending to present at this interested party meeting. And the second focus we'll have is the information that you have here, which is going to be similar to the first round that we did, except it's going to have a different routing study for the option B associated with it. We are planning to conduct these interested party meetings as a single meeting with a presentation type of format. And we're planning to schedule these for the end of August, the end of this month, or the beginning of September timeframe is what we currently have planned to be able to do these. After completion of next round of interested party meetings, we will have a report similar to what we had on option A for option B on the evaluation results that were given to council, that we will be given to council. Also, after that report, we will have basically the route selection process for option B caught up with where option A is on the route selection process. So at that time, option A and option B will kind of be at the same stage, and then we can start wading through the final selection stages of this process. And I would certainly imagine that some of these final selection stages will have a lot of undergrounding implications, cost, and scenarios involved with those steps of the process.
Any other questions?
Move to report 131-11.
Board, at this point, is informational. Mayor, as you know well, you asked for some input, and these reports from the Chief of Police, from CPRB, and from CPOA, I think, fulfill that request, and they're formally transmitted tonight.
Thank you. I asked for these reports. I think these reports are extremely well done all across the board. I think they give a thorough look at the different perspectives of the Citizens Police Review Board from the administration standpoint, from the police officer standpoint, and from the review board standpoint. And obviously, it's our intent that the Citizens Police Review Board have the confidence of the community, and that its goal is to make sure the police department has the confidence of the community. So we all agree on that. As I look at the three reports and collate the three reports together, I find seven, maybe I should call them differences of opinion. Let me kind of go over the seven differences of opinion between the three groups. Number one, misconduct definition. There is a recommendation by the Chief of Police to have a definition that is based on state statute. The Citizens Police Review Board has a different definition that they believe should be used. Secondly, there is a difference of opinion about who has standing to make an appeal. We dealt with that a little bit in the past, but it is the opinion of the police department and the CPOA, the Officers Association, that to have standing to file an appeal, you should be directly involved in it, or be a guardian or a parent.
Right.
The Citizen Police Review Board has a broader definition of who should have standing. Third distinction is Section 21-54G, which allows opening closed personnel files and closed criminal reports, and both the police chief's recommendation and the CPOA's recommendation is to not do that. That's not the opinion of the review board. The fourth difference is the interview and investigative authority of the review board, and it's an open question that we're wrestling with. Should this be an open, transparent initiative in an effort to maintain and keep the confidence of the community? Are there circumstances under which interviews can and should be closed to the general public? What are the criteria for those? Who can request that? Theoretically, a complainant may not want to voice her complaint in public. Similarly, a police officer may not want to be questioned in public. It's an open question, but it is a question. That's the fourth. The fifth is a recommendation from the Chief of Police for training standards for review board members. More defined, I guess the word rigorous is, I don't know if that may be too strong of a word. Sixth difference is a Citizens Police Review Board request that CPD policies are posted online. I know there's an issue about that you don't want all of your policies online for professional reasons or whatever, but that's a difference of opinion, number six. And seven is requiring review board wants the CPD to provide monthly and annual reports containing information on complaints. I guess the way I'm looking at this is this. I think we need to get some definition. Both the Citizens Police Review Board is responsible to the City Council through statute, through ordinance. The police department is responsible to the
city council through the city manager. So we obviously are at the top of the organizational chart. I'd like to see this worked out. And what I'd like to do is to state what the differences of opinion are and give the organizations an opportunity to see if all seven of these remain differences of opinion. They may not. If they do, I think I personally think it's our duty to resolve these differences of opinion. We need to define what the role of the Citizens Police Review Board is. So, if there are differences of opinion that remain after 2 months of discussion, I'm going to ask the City Council to consider changing the ordinance. I don't know how I'm going to vote on these, but I think it's worthy of public debate and formal input and a public hearing. And that gives, it would take 2 weeks you would ask for the ordinance, take 2 weeks to get the first reading, two more weeks to get it out. So we're talking 3 months to get this resolved. But I think this is an opportunity for the council to look at the relationship and decide if it's the relationship we want, to fine-tune that relationship. We're all after the same thing. But I do think it's time to add some clarity to it. Comments? Ben?
Well put. I mean, I think we need to spend time so that everybody knows exactly what the expectation is and we can all kind of find a common ground to work toward it.
So we'll move now to general comments by public counsel and staff. I'll yield 3 minutes to anyone from the public who wishes to speak.
My name is Carl Scala, 5201 Gasconade Drive. Mr. Mayor and Council, I wasn't intending to speak, but it occurred to me when you passed the resolution in your last item in new business about solar electric photovoltaic systems that a couple of years ago, when on the council, we provided some infrastructure for photovoltaic on the roof of this building. It was soon after the green roof option was not passed, and instead was a reflective roof was put on the building with infrastructure in place to support photovoltaics when that option became viable economically. And I was wondering if that might not be an extension of some of the efforts that the city is making with regard to photovoltaics, and it might be certainly fulfilling the nature of the issue when the building was approved.
Thank you.
I forgot. Do I say my name and address and all that? Alice Turner.
No, but go ahead.
Hi. I'm unable to be here on August 13th when you were having an 8 a.m. Saturday public hearing on the FY 2012 budget. So I just thought I'd share something in reading some of the coverage in the newspaper, a concern of mine. So it has to do with the bus transportation service, and I am speaking as a citizen, but I am on the Public Transportation Commission. So I looked up energy today and on the Department of Natural Resources website. You know, I thought I'd come up with a really groovy fact, you know, that would interest you, or maybe. The thing that did strike me is they said, well, if you weren't going to be using motorized transit, which most of us do, especially it's pretty hot outside, is that then it wasn't hybrids or carpooling or driving habits, slowing down, that would save the most energy. It was using public transit. And I think we're all very proud that we've been able to have public transit in Columbia, Missouri, even though we're not the biggest town. I'm from the East Coast originally. In the budget, these are difficult times. There's a proposal to cut 26% from the transit budget. And I don't have all the details about it. I did make a couple calls today, but all the transportation people are at a city meeting out of town. So anyway, What I wanted to say was that, you know, cuts on the, was it Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night till 10 o'clock, that may be warranted, that may be very low ridership. Cuts on Saturday service by an hour, that may not be too big an impact. Of course, the final price tag, if I understood it, was cuts of about $3 million, if I understood it correctly. But the thing I wanted to say is that perhaps this is an opportunity for us to refocus and really look at a leaner, smarter, possibly smarter transportation system. But there's one area, you know, we have service in the morning, we have some service during the day, but one area that we're really lacking in is commuter service from 6 to 7 o'clock at night. And a recent survey by bus patrons showed really strong interest in that. You know, if we get people to work in the morning, they still need to get home at night. So given all these cuts, that's just something I hope we can re-examine. I talked about that when we had the new bus changes in the fall, and it was said that that would be about $110,000. Now, given that we're cutting some in the evening service, it would be higher. But anyway, I just hope that you can look at that. I think that's a really important need, and maybe this is an opportunity to do that. So thanks for listening.
Thank you. For the record, August 13th is a work session, which is a public session, but not a public hearing. There will be three public hearings.
Okay.
August 15th and both meetings in September, there will be public hearings. So there will be three opportunities for public comment. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I just jumped the gun a little.
It's okay.
And if I may, two points. August 22nd, yet another meeting.
Okay.
But this one devoted to this subject, transit.
Really? Okay.
It's not a public hearing, but it's a council work session, so I encourage.
So one can get more information on.
Absolutely. And, you know, at this stage, there's a lot of numbers flying in the community and the press, and it's hard to sort it all. So I'll just stress the budget message that I produced has probably the fundamental. There's two problems, short-term, long-term.
Right.
And let me stress, because I've gotten a few calls about this, you know, the city staff is in the bus business, and we are predisposed to want to do more. That's one reason we spend more than we take in. In fact, it's not a philosophy here that we're acting out. It is simply budgetary. So the core problem is that we spend more than we take in.
Sure.
The biggest difference in the cut is actually quite small compared to the 26% number that is thrown around. That number includes capital. So last year we bought buses. This year we're not buying buses. So almost all of that is related to the actual bus. So the cuts we're proposing are quite a bit smaller. There's a list, I think, in the we set the date of a hearing tonight. There's an agenda item where all of those are listed, what we're going to propose. That's staff's proposal, my proposal in the budget, all of which is changeable by council as we move through the process to find a way to fund the transit system. So
has to be sustainable, right?
That's right.
And we, of course, as the Transportation Commission, we did definitely vote that the rate should be raised, definitely needed, and realistic, you know. Anyway, I just wanted to get that in, particularly about the evening commute times, because I've actually given people rides to and from places, and they just can't get home from work, you know, and so it just makes sense to me.
Thank you for your comments. This is going to be a very robust discussion. Yes.
Good evening. My name is Ashley Cuddle, and I'm the executive director of the Columbia Police Officers Association. I don't have any comments at this time. I just wanted the council to be aware that a member of CPOA is here tonight. So if you should have any questions about our report, we'd be happy to answer those for you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Council.
I have two items. One is that I was very impressed with the CPRB applicants. And we had a good opportunity to hear from six of them tonight. And I would hope that these people would reapply as opportunity arises, that they would keep their eye on the CPRB openings. We learned a lot today from the applicants. They had varying ideas that I think would help contribute to the debate, so I hope we see more of these people. I hope they attend meetings as well and give us their ideas. My second comment was on reapportionment, and we as council appoint a committee to stay out of it because we really shouldn't be voting on our own seats, and that's why we have a committee. What I think is interesting is that we've completely forgotten in the current debate, I'm not hearing anything about the original reason for the existence of Ward 1, which is explicitly in the reports of the committees from 10 and 20 years ago, which was to maximize the likelihood of minority representation. And Ward 1 was created. Ward 1 has had minority representation. And in the current debate, what I'm hearing a lot from the people is about the character of downtown and the character of the neighborhoods and how the neighborhoods fit together. I'm hearing nothing about the original purpose of Ward 1. And I noticed that one of the criteria that staff was given was to keep all original sitting council members in the ward that they're currently serving. And it may be time to go back and look at the cutting Columbia up and the pizza pie slices, because nobody seems to want to be in Ward 1. And I'm a little surprised the committee hasn't come back with the pie slice option. That's all I have tonight.
Thank you. Mr. Dudley?
I've talked to some people in Ward 4 and in Ward 1 about PCC, about private common collectors. And I'd like to get a report on all the places that we have the private common collectors and kind of a timeline on where they're going to. In talking with staff, there isn't really a timeline. It's just as they come up, I guess the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And I just wonder if there's any kind of a timeline that we have on the private common collectors. That's it for me.
Nothing for me.
A couple of things. We'll be asking a couple of weeks to vote on a recommendation to concerning Roots and Blues to forgive the $20,000 police fee for having police at Roots and Blues. What I'd like to know is, in prior to that, in conjunction with that, is I'd like to have an estimate of the sales tax received from the event, total cost for the police to cover Roots and Blues, the total amount of money given by the Convention and Visitors Bureau to Roots and Blues, and the estimated money received from hotel tax during Roots and Blues event by the CBB. Compare those to see where we are on what we're spending versus what we could gain. I'd like to have a report on that.
It's a shame there's no way to, there's other spending too that those people in town have. I mean, they go to restaurants and
yes,
go to the malls, but, you know.
The other thing I have is, can I get that report? Okay. The other thing I'd like to say is received a request from a downtown merchant who would like to have his business noted in the form of a proclamation. He's been in business 23 years now in the same location downtown. And I think this is might be a good program for the CID to take on for downtown businesses, to recognize businesses who are the people who stay downtown and keep their businesses down in the downtown area. So I'd like to recommend that we remand this over to the CDB to maybe come up with some guidelines to recognize these businesses as they spend years in the downtown area.
This evening we received a report at our pre-council session from the DLC, Downtown Leadership Council, regarding the Downtown Charette Report, which I've had the pleasure of looking at several times. at P&Z level and tonight. It's a great report. It was commissioned and done by H3 Studio Inc. And DLC asked us to adopt the plan. We have accepted it, but we have not adopted it, and we are asking that we would like to refer that to council so that we can get a report back on the recommendations and the adoption.
To the staff?
Yes,
to come
to
back
staff.
To council?
Yes, to come back to council. The second thing I wanted to discuss was I've received several calls, three actually, regarding the sanitary sewer rate ordinance that was amended, I believe, back on March 21st, 2011. We've got some, I guess some of the proposals went into effect recently that are resulting in some increase in sewer charges. And we've had some questions by some residential homeowners that may be unfairly, it may not be exactly as equitable as we thought it would be. I've asked, I'm asking for a report from staff on whether we have accomplished all the goals we had set forth in passing that ordinance. I know they're already looking at it and seeing how many people are being unfairly affected, and so I'd like to maybe wait until the end of the summers because it's just gone into effect. People are just starting to call. I don't know if anyone else has received a call, but I would like to have a report. I guess the other part, now I know there's the winter quarter average that seems to be the issue, and that's how the sewer rate is calculated on water usage, but I have also had some complaints from people that may not be, well, they feel that they're unfairly treated, specifically a developer up in the Fifth Ward who has spec houses, who is watering his lawns on his spec houses and being charged a sewer charge for water that is not going into the sewer. Now, I don't know if that's something we can also address in that report, but I'd like to try.
Any other comments? Let the record show that the meeting is adjourned at 8:02.